Welcome and good morning, everyone. Just one correction. I'm the Chief Risk Officer of Purple Group Limited, but I'm also the Group Director of Investments. And so I look after some of our investment businesses like Easy Asset Management and Easy ETFs. And then from a group compliance, governance, risk, sustainability, you name it, we're a fintech, you do jack of all trades. I look after all of the group entities, and you might know some of them: Easy Equities, Easy Crypto, Easy Properties, GT247, Rise, etc. So we're in the startup space, and I think there's lots of exciting things to do. And philosophically, we are very much tied to the whole sustainability construct. So I'm very privileged and honored to be moderating this panel of esteemed experts. And as I've said, economists, I think some of the best economists in South Africa. So I think we'll get some wonderful insights. But what I wanted to suggest is I'm going to give each one of them an opportunity to just quickly introduce themselves, although they probably don't need any introductions, but I think I'm just going to give them that opportunity. And then I'm going to ask them to give introductory remarks on the specific topic. Obviously, it's quite a challenging one, unlocking climate capital. If we all knew the answers, we wouldn't be here today. But yeah, so economic imperatives for a sustainable future. And hopefully we can share some wisdom and some thoughts that can plant some seeds that can help us unlock those challenges. So I'm going to start with them introducing themselves, and then they're going to do some opening remarks. And then if you want to jot down some questions so long, I want to make this engaging and interactive. So I'll give you an opportunity to then ask some questions. So think about those so long. And then we're going to start with the introductions. Gina, should we start with you?
Good morning, everybody. I'm Gina Skuman. I'm with Citibank. For the purposes of this panel discussion, the economist covering South Africa. I do a couple of other things across different regions, but very glad to be here and thank you for having me.
Hi, everyone. My name is Sinisha Pakrasami. I'm the economist for Momentum Investments Group. Basically, my role there is to interpret economic data. We fold that into an asset allocation process in order to generate risk-adjusted returns for our client portfolios. With our business becoming a little bit more globally integrated, I do have a specific focus on South Africa, but incrementally so, we also have a broader focus on global dynamics and how it affects the South African landscape. Thanks very much for having me as well.
Great, thanks.
Hi, I'm Annabelle Bishop. I look at macroeconomics for Investec. We obviously do a lot of forecasting, and of course, we do look at the global and domestic to bring into our regulatory processes, as well as feed into a number of other different areas into Investec. Particularly, of course, we're involved in the IFRS 9, the ICAP, climate change, now many other processes, but of course, also as well, client interactions, and obviously looking at the general impacts that we have seen most recently, such as elections and other areas as well, which do have an impact all on our economic outlook and really trying to feel our way forward in quite a volatile economy.
Good morning. I'm Mhlanga. I'm with RMB. I look after a team that looks after the global macroeconomy covering several African countries, India, the UK, and the US. To inform our clients in terms of developments and how that impacts their business and our own.
Great, thanks, Azai. I think we've had a good introduction already, but I think just to set the context for the panel, I'll give us a little bit of insights from sort of local and global regulators. So even though recent studies have highlighted that the awareness of economic consequences of climate transition is relatively new, which is according to the IMF, we are though seeing that countries are starting to grasp with this now, and specifically the ramifications, which I suppose is a good trend. And then in South Africa specifically, National Treasury indicates that the country is also recognizing these impacts, and they're emphasizing the need for robust analytical tools, which we hope some have started to unlock, tailored specifically for our unique economic and social context, which I think is very important. The strengths and the weaknesses of those modeling tools is obviously the challenge here, both in South Africa as well as globally. And I think the OECD really spoke about there can be hugely valuable insights from the potential or into the potential impacts of the mitigation strategies. But these tools really struggle to predict the long-term economic outcomes. And I think those are some of the challenges because there's very complex interplay of various factors, which I think we can maybe talk about. In terms of DBSA, they highlight the models must obviously consider the social economic disparities as well as our energy dependencies. So those are the sort of local dynamics we've got to consider. The SARB also talks about the models failing to consider those social and distributional effects adequately. And those are critical for comprehensive policy assessment as well as considering obviously our diverse society and the context locally. And then lastly, from a public policy perspective, it's imperative that we consider the full economic as well as social implications and that the tools obviously consider that, and the World Bank emphasizes the accurate and inclusive economic modeling, which influences both policy decisions, but also the local public opinion. And then the CSIR then obviously just stresses the importance that of the tailored models for local policy development. So yeah, I think with that construct and background, because Gina has to leave earliest, I'm going to ask her, and maybe not with a specific sort of climate hat on, but just talk generally about your view on South Africa's current economic outlook. I think Annabelle has sort of given a sense. Obviously, the local elections have had lots of insights, and all of you have been chatting to each other about insights. So yeah, let's start with that, and then we'll take the conversation forward.
If ever we were in a position to make some further inroads into climate change, I would say now is it. And the reason I say this is because we've got a government of national unity. We've got a cabinet that, at least in the near term, and I'd say that the next 3 years before we move into another election cycle, local elections, we have a cabinet that has healthy competition and a willingness to work together. And so with this goodwill nature, and I would already argue, and I'm very happy to be corrected on this, but South Africa's already behind on climate change issues and trying to transition ourselves in a much better way. This is the opportunity we have now. We have a window of opportunity now in the second half of the year where there's a rising sentiment expected on South Africa because of the post-election cabinet outcome. You're already starting to see, I know it's all talk and we always want the action, and we do have a track record of all talk, no action, but we're starting to see ministers coming out with a lot that they want to get done. And I know we've had this before, but this is an opportunity for all the various political parties to show what they're worth. And so if you start looking across cabinet and you start looking at, you know, inflation coming down, we've got some cyclical tailwinds in the second half of the year that can really start to push up growth. And I'm not saying we're going to shoot the lights out, but we've got inflation coming down. We've got some potential rate cuts. That's all the cyclical side of growth. But then we've also got, and we should pat ourselves on the back, we have reduced almost no load shedding at the moment. And if this continues, it will continue to push up sentiment on South Africa. Then, of course, 2025 comes along and that's the real business. Now we need to start making further inroads into other reforms such as Transnet, ports, railway capacity. We need to make sure that fiscally, we actually are able to consolidate things. And there's a lot of creative thinking around that. But we do really have an opportunity here over the medium term, 1 to 3 years, to push this economy up. And I don't just mean cyclically, I mean structurally here. From this 0 to 1% growth economy in real terms to at least a 1 to 2% economy. And believe me, that's still not enough, right? With population growth roughly around 1.5% in per capita terms, you want to go above 1.5%. But I also think that slow incremental improvement over the next 3 years is more permanent. We don't want to rush into things either. And then, of course, things get a little bit more blurry because we've got party elections, the ANC, the DA, how will leadership change there? How will that impact the GNU? How will these parties be able to compete in local municipal elections while still holding it together on a national and provincial basis? You know, political parties will posture at some points, and obviously their differing opinions on policies that they all want in place in South Africa will start to emerge. But still, 3 years is a good window of opportunity for this economy to really start pushing itself further. And let me also remind you, and I mean, we've got some very more experts on climate change economics here on this panel than myself. But I think we all know that when you start to look at things like climate change, anything actually really in ESG, you've got an appetite in the world for this change to take place, but it does come at a cost. And those costs can be inflationary if they're not managed correctly. Inflation is clearly one of the most toxic things for this economy because, well, we don't really save. We've got a large number of consumers. Consumer spending drives GDP growth. So, you know, all of this needs to be managed very carefully. But it's a lot easier to manage all of that. It's a lot easier to take on those costs and to transition if you're running at a better growth rate, with a better goodwill feeling, more sentiment, more positivity around the economy, than to look at a government, a country, and say, well, I mean, you can't even reform yourselves. How do we expect you to be able to change and transition correctly? So we do have a window of opportunity here. I think the whole world is looking at South Africa coming out in this government of national unity, having already made some positive inroads into energy, and certainly, I mean here, just load shedding. And now seeing whether this can sustain. It means that we have more confidence, we can get more investment, but we need to create a track record. And that means data points of about 18 to 24 months for people to really to look at and say, well, if South Africa can do it, then maybe we can invest further. And that investment obviously has a big stake in climate change. So let me leave it there just in the interest of time. Thank you, Nicola.
Great. Thanks, Gina. So I suppose, Sanisha, you have to guide me in terms of, do you want to give a little bit of insights on your perspective on economic imperatives for sustainable future, on a bit more unlocking climate capital, or go on the same insights that Gina's done?
Sure. So, I mean, there's nothing I can disagree with from Gina's perspective. I mean, we don't have the economic resilience that a number of developed market counterparts might have when embarking on a mission to mitigate against climate change. So we've come out of, the global financial crisis. Since then, growth in South Africa has averaged below 1.5%. So a very paltry growth rate in South Africa. And of course, alongside that, we've had an increase in inequality, a rise in unemployment. And that's really the backdrop that we come from when we start to contextualize how to then adopt climate mitigation strategies in South Africa. So quite a difficult background to do that in. And I think when we think about unlocking capital for climate change mitigation practices, we need to do it in the most sensible way. In an emerging market that is quite reliant on the fossil fuel industry, there are large portions of communities that are still very reliant on those industries taking place. And so moving away from that means that we do have quite a large burden on our fiscus in order to ensure that we still have social cohesion in a world where we are trying to adapt ourselves to a cleaner environment. And I think really taking that into account means that we'll be able to generate high levels of economic growth and productivity going forward in an inclusive manner. I think in terms of unlocking that climate capital, it really all starts in terms of the policy arrangement and the regulatory background. And again, this is where emerging markets tend to fall short against developed markets because of the institutional bodies and the strength of those regulations coming through. In South Africa's context, it's quite important for us to set that at a national level. And of course, I mean, the timing was great yesterday, of course, the climate bill being signed in. That, of course, sets the scene. You know, that's the national policy agenda, but it's quite important for that national policy agenda to then permeate throughout the various spheres of government. So starting at national, going at provincial, and then ending off at local government level. I think if we take the background of South Africa, given that we've had, you know, a geographical spatial inequality for a number of decades, that is the living reality in SA. So we do need to have policy actions that are quite targeted and quite specific to various areas. I don't think we can take, you know, a big brushstroke across all sectors and say this is how we're going to apply it everywhere. We know that various communities suffer from different challenges, and I think this is, key in unlocking that climate capital for South Africa, taking a more targeted approach to policy. The other, you know, sort of last issue I'll just touch on there in terms of unlocking that capital for climate change is to really ensure that we have cohesion across all the stakeholder groups. I think that's quite important in order to have policies that are aligned from a socioeconomic perspective, a political perspective, and just general economic growth perspective, taking into account that we do have quite a stretched fiscus. And so that is, you know, our fiscal reality that we are living with as well. So really trying to, you know, unlock the climate capital in the most sensible way, and really being alert of, you know, what we can and can't achieve over the next couple of years, given the economic and fiscal realities that we live with.
Great, thanks. I think that sets it up quite nicely, coming from the economic sort of perspective, the political and the fiscal situation. And I think, Annabelle, I think this really sets us up nicely into going into a bit more of the sort of tangible work that you've done over the last couple of years around climate modeling. And I don't know whether you've managed to address some of these challenges that the IMF, et cetera, are quoting, but we'd be interested to hear some of that. Thanks. And before you start, just a reminder, questions after Azai has spoken, it's open to the floor.
Yes, hi. Look, I think it's important to note I am first and foremost a macroeconomist. And I think, you know, what economists do is they perhaps bring a different way of thinking to climate change. When you look at climate change and the body of work that's been done, the scientists, the experts, climate change finance itself, of course, it is the primary object and primary focus. However, from a macroeconomic perspective, when you look at climate change, it's one of many objectives or focuses in an economy. And of course, that's what goes into your models. We look obviously at a number of different areas, but perhaps just to break it down, there are two main categories, transition risk and of course, physical risk. So physical risk, as you know, can either be acute or chronic. And of course, when you talk about acute physical risk, you might talk about the damaging impacts of a flood, a very severe drought, you know, cyclones, weather-related severe instances. And of course, we've seen that in KwaZulu-Natal in 2022, the cyclone that hit. We've also, of course, as well, seen more recently floods in areas of the countries as well. The chronic physical risk that comes through that we look at in our work obviously can include the effects, the ongoing longer-term effects, such as global warming. And of course, that then translates through into the warming of oceans, the effects on ocean currents, and many other areas as well. Looking at chronic risk, we also perhaps just tie back for those of you in the room perhaps who just might want to know, you know, what we base it on, although many of you, of course, do know this, is that looking at the efforts to limit global warming to about 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial times, bearing in mind that we're already around 1.1, 1.2 degrees. So these effects really come through in terms of looking at limiting emissions, greenhouse gases. And of course, you know, the imperative here really is the fact that in economics, both demand, which is obviously consumption and the production factors result in negative externalities from economics. So greenhouse gases in economic sense are negative externalities. And it really asks then, who's picking up the cost? Are we free riders? People are benefiting from production and consumption. And just to adhere to what the previous speaker was saying at the start of the conference, he was talking about nature. And obviously, you know, nature gives us many assets for free. Now, of course, you know, that really brings in the free rider component as well from an economic perspective. Mopping up these greenhouse gases, mitigating climate change, working to reduce emissions, obviously then comes through from a public good perspective in economic policy. So incorporating all of these into macroeconomic models, you know, obviously there are some backgrounds, some areas that we look at, but there's little work that's really been done from a benchmarking perspective in South Africa for climate change modeling, partly because the prudential authority, our South African Reserve Bank, hasn't yet, perhaps in the same way as it has for other regulatory requirements such as IFRS 9, ICAP, etc., you know, required deliverables yet. But it's coming down the line. They've issued papers on climate change. A couple of years ago, we did do a stress test exercise for South Africa, which required modeling in terms of the impacts of drought, rainfall, etc. But really overall, you know, what we are looking at is trying to, from a South Africa-specific perspective, bring the physical risks that South Africa has experienced and which we expect is going to experience going forwards into our modeling capability, along with obviously the transition risks that I mentioned earlier. Transition risks obviously being the impact on the economy of putting in place climate mitigation. And of course, that includes perhaps transitions to different types of energy production, green energy, clean energy. It also, of course, as well, includes many other areas as well. Transition risk, of course, therefore has an impact on economic variables. And this is where I'm leading to. What does all of this impact in terms of inflation, GDP growth, and also, of course, as well, what are the risks if we perhaps implement the climate mitigation in a late as opposed to an early approach? And what if we don't implement climate mitigation at all? Overall, it really comes to a global effort. As we know, advanced economies, developed economies are further down the line in terms of limiting greenhouse gas emissions than your emerging market, your developing economies are. And again, as well, there are costs that are involved. So we have been looking at all of these areas, but again, from a macroeconomic lens, from looking at how does that affect the economy, bearing in mind that South Africa is starting off from a weak point in terms of government finances. Several years ago, it might even have been a couple of decades ago, government finances were expected to bear the brunt, government debt, of the impact of climate adaption, also, of course, as well, what happens in terms of loss and damage. And of course, we have seen that in South Africa when we saw the KwaZulu-Natal floods, government stepping in to provide assistance. But really, where I'd like to end off is saying that while we can do this work and look at what has happened, where we expect things to go, it's difficult from a macroeconomic process when you model more than a few years in advance. If you're looking to model 50 years in advance, 100 years in advance, even the scientists themselves don't know exactly how climate change is going to play out, what the effects are going to be in terms of the weather patterns. So all of these also provide limitations on modeling, but I think I'll stop there.
Great, thanks. So as the thorn amongst the roses, you've got the privilege, or shall I say the hard task, to follow on all of those insights shared. I don't know if you from R&B side have got any other insights or perspectives that can help us unlock this. I know, like Annabelle said, it's, you know, we're working with a lot of unknown variables here, but let's hear your insights. Thanks.
Thank you very much. A thorn among rose, or rose among thorns. Thanks to the organizers for putting a panel of women. In most cases, we have men that hog the mic. I would like to perhaps take a different view. Climate change is a global phenomenon, but its impact is localized. So the approach in terms of mitigation can only succeed if it is globally tackled. Like how we learned in COVID, no one is safe until everybody is safe. And that has significant consequences in terms of what we can do at a country level. Do we focus on mitigation or we focus on adaptation? There's nothing that we can do as a country to change the cause of climate change if we are doing it alone, because our contribution into the global emissions is very tiny. Even if we are the largest emitter in the African continent, the continent as a whole only emits 4% or has contributed 4% in terms of global carbon emissions. If it's not done at a global level, what we do is going to amount to naught. And we could say there are certain outcomes that we sit with if we progress on the current trajectory. The first speaker spoke about uncertainties. I would rephrase that to say it's actually quite certain what we are facing. And the certainty comes from the fragmentation in terms of how we are approaching the mitigation. Countries have different decarbonization paths. Some have 2075, is India. Much later, some are not even participating. Some have 2050. That implies there is no global effort to actually address this. But also, some countries have different levels of resilience and the ability to adapt, which means their efforts into mitigation is not as much as those countries that have less resilient and that are being impacted the most. That has one outcome. 1.5 degrees limit might not be achieved. simply because it's not a coordinated global effort. The implication, therefore, is what we currently see is not a full reflection of climate change, such that when the impact comes, it's going to be drastic and it's going to have significant impact than what we see currently. Even when you look in terms of asset prices, they are not reflective of climate change risk. A lot of academic studies have failed to pick up any climate beta or climate premium, which means it's either they have been perfectly good to price it in such that it's no longer there, or they have missed it completely. It's not priced in at all, which means when it comes, it's going to be a shock. It's going to be disruptive. So it's actually certain in terms of where the impact. It's not uncertain. It's very certain because of human behavior. We haven't adapted. We haven't mitigated. So the outcome is certain. It's going to be a disruptive and painful process. I think that's the beginning point. And then we can then say, as South Africa, what do we do? I think we all agree that the sole purpose of economists, if there is one, is to study trade-offs in terms of how we make decisions. And those trade-offs for us, we saw it with the likes of Germany. When they had electricity issues, they imported so much coal such that our coal exports rose by 700%. In the midst of discussions to try and mitigate climate change, it's a trade-off which says in the interim, we need energy. Burning carbon is energy, is economic growth. There's a direct link between your energy consumption and economic growth. But over the long term, we still need to make commitments that say we need to transition. So to speak about climate finance, it has to be a deliberate action to say we need to transition over this period, and we have to make commitments in terms of the trade-offs that we do in continued use of the energy sources that we have now and what would contribute into a transition over the long term. Those are the trade-offs that we need to do. But even if we were to do that as a country, we can contribute as long as it's not at a global scale. We will not be able to change the course of climate change. So it has to be really a global conversation in the same way that a COVID response was a global conversation.
Very, very true indeed. The one thing that I suppose gives us some light at the end of the tunnel, or certainly uplifts my spirits in this space, is we are having more practical conversations about this. And we recently, I think earlier this year, we had a CFA South Africa Society day where we workshopped specifically with asset owners. So this is now on the asset management side around what are the things we can do. And actuaries, there were quite a lot of actuaries in that conversation. And now we've got economists in that conversation. So for me, it's about all leaning in. And like you've said, I mean, as a risk manager, that's music to my ears. There's no such thing as climate risk. There's no uncertainty. There's a certainty. It is what it is. It's an event that's already occurred. There's many examples. Annabelle referred to some of them. I think the uncertainty for us is just the severity of the impact if we don't act fast enough. And so I think you've given a beautiful backdrop. And so now we are open to the floor in terms of anyone wanting to lean in with questions. Otherwise, I will hog the economist's time.
Good morning. My name is Xolisa Dlamini from Sanlam. Thank you for a good conversation so far. On the topic of leaning in, we've seen that our president has found his pin and he's been using it lately. So now we have a Climate Change Act. And I know that there was the launch of the Climate Change Response Fund at the last budget speech. And I think now they're in the process of kind of conceptualizing it, right? And so it gives a sense of, okay, amongst all the various stakeholders, you know, economists, actuaries, government, what are your views around to what extent government has leaned in sufficiently for us to tackle this? And what more do you think needs to happen? And how do you as also players lean in and actually drive this climate conversation considering where we are now?
Couple of comments from my side, and I'm sure there's a lot more on this topic. So at Citibank, I look after our institutional clients. And that's globally and locally, but you can imagine how large it is globally. We already have clients that are not able to invest as much as they used to in South Africa, government bonds and equities, more government bonds though, because we are not ticking enough ESG boxes. That's how simple it is. And this is what I meant about being behind. There are other emerging markets that are ticking more boxes. So they actually are not allowed. And so this is where we can do more. Annabelle mentioned it, you know, the Saab and Treasury, I think, not to criticize them too much. They are beacons of hope as always, but, and Treasury never likes it when I say this. We are very orthodox in our financing of public finances. It's a good thing. It stands us in very good stead at times, but we need to become a bit more creative in this space. I have been talking to Treasury about green bonds for years. And we're still not tackling it. But again, that goes back to what I said initially, is that we need to be able to focus away from all the things that catch us unaware because we're not prepared for them. Because that takes away all the focus of the institutions to these immediate crises at hand. And we need to be able to have that space, which hopefully we can get a little bit more of over the next 3 years if we're not trying to convince people all the time to come and invest, because, of course, the investment case has now started. And we need more attention there. And this is where the presidency, Operation Vulindlela, you know, I hope that because of the signing of the bill yesterday, it starts to become a question that when I go into these meetings with all of the policymakers in South Africa, and this is going to shock a room full of people who are here about climate change. When I write an economic report about South Africa and I write about the macro outlook, we don't tackle climate change because it's not a priority yet. And it needs to lift up as a priority because otherwise, as everyone has said, it is a certainty that over the next 10 years, things are already changing and things will change. Right? Agriculture in South Africa has already changed as a result. But I'm going to hand over to my esteemed colleagues or my friends here. And also, I'm so sorry I have to leave because the timetable changed. But thank you so much for having me today. Thank you.
Perhaps I can add to Gina's points and try to answer a little bit more direct in whether government have leaned in or not. Over the last 3 years or so, there have been a change in terms of electricity regulation. The embedded limit, which was there of 1 megawatt, was removed completely. And the pipeline of renewable energy projects sits at 22,500 megawatts, precisely because government have leaned in. So I think not recognizing that would be, from our perspective, a little bit dishonest. Private sector is now responsible for, or will be responsible for, building new energy capacity. Eskom shall never invest in any other coal fire plant. It's a position government has taken, essentially recognizing the fact that coal is a carbon, it contributes to carbon emissions. So government has already leaned in terms of the policies which they've taken, and we are seeing the impact in terms of the private sector investing in renewable energy. What we also need to see is private capital, long-term capital, leaning in and investing a lot more in renewable energy. I'm sure Premal, when he speaks later on, can give us a little bit of information in terms of what is the contribution of the pension fund industry in investing in renewable energy. A lot of the investments currently have been done from a banking perspective. We need the patient, long-term capital to come and play a role and invest in renewable energy. So that's the one part that is not well embedded. Maybe it's beginning phases, but we need to see more investments from long-term savings spaces.
I'm sure we've got lots of other insights to share, but I think just to give one more opportunity for a question, we've got a hand there at the back of the room.
Yes, hello.
Oh,
hi.
There we go. Where are we?
Thank you very much. My name is Kanya and I'm from UNICEF. I am by no means an economist or anything. So please forgive me if my question is a bit rudimentary. But what the gentleman said from RMB was very profound, where he said that climate change needs to be a global phenomenon. And certain policies have been implemented to discourage the carbon emissions and so on and so on. And carbon neutral organizations are incentivized through carbon credits. But this question is actually posed to Ms. Annabelle. I would like to know, a lot of it, especially from the European context, the behavioral change, they have managed to elicit a behavioral change due to the incentivization of finding sustainable energy sources and eco-friendly alternatives. And I just wanted to know, what is the financial feasibility of implementing this in South Africa? Can we afford it? Can we afford to actually implement a behavioral change through incentivization? Yeah, thank you.
Thanks very much for your question. I think it does talk to behavioral economics. And I think, you obviously look at the carrot and stick approach. And here you're talking about the carrot approach, or obviously incentivizing behavioral changes. Interestingly, we noted in Germany, they went through a phase of offering free public transport to try and encourage behavior. In other words, get people to feel, who weren't perhaps taking public transport, what it'd be like to take public transport to obviously reduce emissions. And of course, we're talking here in Europe in general, as you mentioned, about a economic bloc, which is an advanced economy, a developed economy, one which arguably has more resources, financial and others, than to drive these types of societal changes. But nevertheless, for South Africa, and again, there's some arguments which we can also bring to the fore as well, but for South Africa, and in terms of globally as well, behavioral economics and consumer choices and changes are necessary to obviously bring us to the point where we actually do start to see both reductions in consumption and, of course, as well, the ability to actually impact substantially the reduction of greenhouse gases. So I think, yes, that's a given, certainly, where we start off from a starting point here. But I think, if we look at other areas as well, the Eurozone's looking to bring in several years' time, the carbon border adjustment mechanism, the CBAM approach, which obviously is going to have an impact globally also on behavioral. And of course, that really talks to countries that export goods that are produced that are carbon intensive in their production, or have a certain level or degree of carbon intensity, which of course is going to be costly for those exporting countries, that the stick approach I was referring to earlier. So, we find ourselves in a situation where the pushback from a developing economies has come, saying that, look, you are advanced economies because you've been through industrialization since the Industrial Revolution. You have obviously been responsible for the majority of the production of greenhouse gases and arguably still are. So as a consequence, we as developing economies, and of course, the IMF, the World Bank also looks at underdeveloped economies as well as another classification, have not had that trajectory, that growth path, which has obviously allowed us to see that rapid economic growth, to move to a high income economy, individuals obviously high income, and of course had that lift in GDP per capita. So you get these arguments on two sides. I think what's also quite notable as well in the behavioral economics aspect that you bring now with this lens is that if we look at COP28 and the decisions taken there, we didn't see, as all of us know, a agreement for a phase out of fossil fuels. We saw a phase down of fossil fuels instead. So perhaps, people outside our area may say these are semantics, but, given the imperatives and the crises that are facing many already from a climate change perspective, and which are obviously coming down the line quite rapidly, and, globally having this impact, you would think, with us and many of us in the room, that you might look at a phase out of fossil fuels by a certain degree. So again, it's this difficulty of affecting behavior. And of course, it's not missed that the carbon exporters, the coal exporters, oil producers, etc., OPEC Plus, all of those areas obviously are worried first of all, about the reduction in fossil fuels, that they'll push against it. You get the pro-oil lobby groups, you get the pro-coal lobby groups, but also, of course, as well, just working with consumers and individuals. Many say, you know, people before us, I remember an example, one lady in an office said, well, everyone else was using disposable nappies when they had their kids. Why must I suddenly now this year used to not be able to allow to use disposable nappies anymore? You know, so again, it's very difficult to change consumers and people's behavior. I think, you know, what obviously is key, maybe just to wrap up and look at an answer to your question, is that in the Eurozone, they've had certain specified goals. You know, they've had very specific achievable targets. But let's be honest here, some of this was brought on as well by the imperative of the Russian-Ukraine war and the move away from importing fossil fuels from Russia, the need to become self-sufficient. So that hurried on a positive aspect and pushed along the switch as well for Europe. So I think, you know, when we have a well-organized economy or economic bloc such as Europe, or when we face middle and low income economies, which have human imperatives, human lives, people who are still seeing children die in poverty, who are still seeing, you know, the harsh effects of inequality and other aspects as well. In these economies, sometimes the climate imperative does get pushed to the side in terms of changing these behavioral economics. And it obviously is, you know, a very difficult situation that we find ourselves in. I think, you know, as I mentioned earlier, CBAM and other will be pushed on us, you know, and that obviously is again results in difficulties for countries that obviously are commodity exporters like South Africa, but also, of course, as well, are trying to push up the industrialization path. So I think it's a very broad topic that you mentioned, but I think also as well, it does get to the nub of the problem. And that is that, you know, in behavioral economics, how do we appeal or try and change to everyone? I mean, in South Africa, if you're not sitting with a flooded house in the Eastern Cape and you're sitting up on the Highveld, perhaps it means less to you. So again, it's difficult to, you know, really try and implement behavioral change, but obviously something that increasingly has become an imperative.
Thanks so much. And so in short, a very good question. Thank you. I looked at this panel, thought it's a very high risk to put four economists together. And I think they've done exceptionally well to keep their answers short and concise and sharp. So thank you so much. And in Gina's absence, I think thank you so much for all the insights and the input. We could have carried on for another hour, and I'm sure there's lots of other questions that you would have loved to ask, but unfortunately we are time bound. So I am going to just sort of wrap up and just say that sort of in summary, Gina started off with talking about our economic targets in terms of growth, really wanting to get to the 1.5-2%, which I think all of us in the room are hopeful for, which will unfortunately just be incremental growth, but hopefully more sustainable. Sanisha spoke a little bit about the fiscal burden, which is obviously sort of a big dark cloud over us. And on the silver lining around those edges is the climate bill that was signed and released yesterday. And so we're seeing some policy movements, and I think that's really critical, the climate change response fund, et cetera. And then I think, you know, Annabelle gave us some good insights, and obviously the actuaries and the economists all need to get together and do some modeling here. And even though there's the target of the limit of the 1.5 degrees, realistically not quite sure whether we'll reach that, like Isaiah said, unless we all get together in terms of real global action being taken together, like we rally together when we face COVID. So I think that's a challenge to all of us in the room in terms of those insights. And I think behavioral economics is like we've all said, that's the nub of the issue here, carrot stick approach. So I'm hoping over the rest of the course of today, you will solve a lot of these challenges that we've just started scratching the surface on. And thanks so much to my panelists.